The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the Small Intestine is presented by Dr. Lindsay Moorhart.
This isn't a very long section of small bowel. Kind of go through this. Probably the longer ones are the liver that we have here. So, all right. So malabsorption, this can occur at different phases in the small bowel. So you have the luminal phase. This is where you're talking about the contact between the ingested food and digestive enzymes. So this is where you're seeing your patients with pancreatic insufficiency. Mucosal phase, you have substances that are assimilated and absorbed in the required constituent form. So this is where you're talking about celiac and Crohn's. And then you have the delivery phase. So nutrients are taken up into the cytoplasm, transported to the lymphatic or portal venous system. So this is where you're talking about like a lymphoma. So diarrhea, there's a couple different mechanisms. You can have the decreased absorption, so this is more of a villus function, or you can have increased secretion. This is more of a crypt function. So back to some cases here. 36-year-old female presents with an 8-week history of recurrent, watery, non-bloody diarrhea. Routine lab and endoscopic infectious evaluation thus far has not really revealed a diagnosis. Which of the following values would suggest a secretory diarrheal etiology? So stool osmolality of less than 290, greater than 290, an osmotic gap of less than 50, or greater than 125, or a stool pH of less than 5.3. So when you're looking at stool osmolality, if it's less than 290, this is usually contaminated. Sometimes this is a clue if someone, you're not, you know, sure they're truly having diarrhea. Sometimes they'll contaminate it with water or urine. Osmotic diarrheas are indicated by a large stool osmotic gap, so at least 50 milliosmoles per kilogram. More specifically, is greater than 100. If you're looking at more of a secretory diarrhea, so here we're looking with a low osmotic gap, less than 50. And carbohydrate malabsorption is marked by a pH of less than 5.3. So that's the calculation down there, 290 minus 2 times the stool sodium and plus potassium. I think they usually always have some type of a question like this, it seems like. So you have the different categories. There's inflammatory, so these patients may have abdominal pain, fever, tenesmus. Stool can be mucus with mucus or bloody. It might be smaller volume. When you're looking at the stool, you can see blood and leukocytes in it microscopically. If you're looking at a non-inflammatory, these people tend to produce more of a watery diarrhea. They're not going to necessarily have a fever or any gross bleeding, and it appears pretty normal on microscopy. So when you're talking about secretory, small and or large intestinal fluid and electrolyte secretion, does this stop with fasting? No. You're going to, again, have that stool osmotic gap of less than 50. And then when you're looking at the osmotic diarrheas, this is more of an ingestion of poorly absorbed cations, anions, sugars, or sugar alcohols. I don't know if anyone's ever seen the video of the Haribo gummy bears. It's not good. The sugar-free ones, anyways. Does this stop with fasting? Yes. And then you're going to see a stool osmotic gap of greater than 100. So this lady, 34, presents with 8-month history of bloating, abdominal pain, relieved with the bowel movement. She tends towards constipation. She has a history of dysmenorrhea, and she has a sister with dermatitis herpetiformis. So that's kind of your clue there. She denies travel, alcohol use, or weight loss. Lab studies demonstrate a mild iron deficiency. The TTG was negative. What's the next best step in this patient's evaluation? Do you want to start Bentyl or dicyclamine? Do you want to do a diagnostic lab? Does she need small bowel biopsies? or are you going to get the anti-gliadin antibody? So this patient needs small bowel biopsies. So when we're looking at celiac disease and dermatitis herpetiformis, up to 10% of the patients with DH will have a family member with a gluten-related enteropathy. GI symptoms of celiac disease range from constipation to diarrhea. We all think that diarrhea is most common, but you certainly can have other manifestations. A lot of these people do meet the Rome criteria for irritable bowel syndrome. Some people will have their sole manifestation as iron deficiency anemia, and it's frequently overlooked in females who are menstruating. And then all symptomatic family members of someone with a gluten-related enteropathy should have small bowel biopsies in addition to serologic screening. So this is a gluten enteropathy. It's genetically inherited, and it's associated with the HLA locus, found on the short arm of chromosome 6. So this is the HLA-DQ2, and it's present in about 95% of patients. You can see here, this is a biopsy slide. It shows the villus flattening in the small bowel. That's the big buzzword. The HLA-DQ2, that's something that we do not use routinely, except for in someone who you've done small bowel biopsies, their TTG is negative, their biopsies are negative, but you're still wondering if they have celiac disease or they're already on a gluten-free diet, they aren't willing to go back off their gluten-free diet, you can use this as well. So the three features, the villus atrophy is the big one, symptoms of malabsorption, these people will often lose weight. You're gonna see resolution of these lesions upon withdrawal of gluten-containing foods. Obviously, we have a lot of people out there now who say that they're gluten sensitive. They aren't going to have the villus blunting, the positive serologies, et cetera. It's just that they don't like gluten in their gut. So one other thing I'll say about that is people may have a number of nonspecific symptoms. I'll have people who came to get tested because of maybe an iron deficiency, very mild, and all of a sudden after they start avoiding gluten when they're diagnosed with it, they start to say, oh, I didn't realize I was so fatigued, I was having these headaches. You'll start to see a resolution of a lot of symptoms they just kind of chalked up to everyday life. So a 58-year-old male presents with diarrhea. His evaluation is positive for TTG. He underwent an EGD and small bowel biopsy, which was consistent with celiac. His colonoscopy is normal. When you look at his labs, his hemoglobin is 11, MCV is 72, so a little microcytic. His ferritin's 12, ELK-FOS, twofold elevation. He has a normal AST and ALT, bilirubin, GGT, normal, fasting glucose 104. Which of the following additional tests would you recommend at this time? Does he need a liver biopsy? Does he need an MRCP, bone marrow biopsy, or a vitamin D? Vitamin D. So these people, one of the leading causes of morbidity in patients with celiac is calcium malabsorption. So these people have osteopenia, osteoporosis, vitamin D malabsorption, osteomalacia. Lab feature of osteomalacia is the elevated alkaline phosphatase. You can fractionate this. You'll see that the bone fraction is elevated. Bone density should definitely be done in newly diagnosed patients with celiac disease, especially in people who, you know, haven't realized they've had it for a long period of time. You may see some changes. This should, again, be done mainly in patients on a gluten-containing diet. Again, the HLA testing is the one exception. So biopsies should be performed in all patients who are suspected of having celiac, regardless of the serologic evidence. A small number of people will have positive serology but normal biopsies. If you have a negative serology, this again does not preclude the presence of the disease. So when you're looking at diagnosis, the anti-gliadin antibody, IgG, is good sensitivity, 83 to 100%. There can be a false positive, however, with cow milk protein intolerance and parasite infection. The anti-endomysial antibody, false negative in IgA deficiency in kids less than 2, and sensitivity is about 97 to 100%, and specificity 98 to 99. Our gold standard is the TTG antibody. Sensitivity is about 90 to 100%, and specificity about 95 to 100%. check IgA in these patients. If they have an IgA deficiency, it could be falsely negative, or you can check both the IgG and IgA values of that. So if you have a positive serology, there's a high probability of celiac disease, you should still get biopsies in these people. They should undergo an EGD. You biopsy in the duodenal bulb in the third portion of the duodenum. Again, this is what we talked about earlier. If there's a suspicion of celiac disease is high, the intestinal biopsy should be pursued, even if serologies are negative. So this is a picture here that you're going to see of celiac disease, but we see endoscopically. It's probably hard to appreciate up here. You get the scalloping of the folds, nodularity, absence of the circular folds in the small intestine. So frequently, it doesn't look this abnormal. Sometimes it just looks like regular small bowel. I had a prisoner that came into the hospital severely iron deficient. He'd probably been celiac his entire life. His bowel looked so flat, it looked like stomach mucosa. So it was very obvious in that patient. So patient with celiac has followed a gluten-free diet now for 6 months. They're doing well, but the diarrhea has now returned. The review of her diet does show that there's been good compliance, and the endomysial antibody testing and TGG is now normal. What's the next step that we're going to do in this patient? Are we going to repeat a small bowel biopsy, a small bowel follow-through? Are we doing a colonoscopy with biopsy? Or are we going to do a bacterial aspirate of the small bowel contents? So this patient needs a colonoscopy. One of the things that we'll see in patients who have celiac disease, they've responded to a gluten-free diet, is something called microscopic colitis. It's a common cause of diarrhea in these patients, and you can detect this with random biopsies in the colon. About 15% of the time, these two diseases do coexist. We go in with a colonoscopy, everything looks normal, but when we look under the microscope, we can see a change that causes this, and it's the microscopic colitis. So next we have this 52-year-old male. He's recently been to Puerto Rico for 3 months. He developed fatigue, malaise, abdominal cramps 1 week after returning. This was followed by diarrhea, dyspepsia. Stools were oatmeal-like, he said. When we look at his labs, he has a macrocytic anemia, so his hemoglobin is 11.3, MCV is 103. You look at stool studies, nothing there that gives you any answer. So you do an enteroscopy. What's the most likely diagnosis? Celiac sprue, Giardia, tropical sprue, or does this person have a lactase deficiency? So tropical sprue. This really can mimic celiac disease. You have to have a good history from these patients. Etiology is unknown, but it's suspected to be infectious. Treatment with tetracycline, folate, you do this for 6 to 12 months. The key that you're going to be looking for in boards, diarrhea, tropics, macrocytic anemia. So celiac disease is a microcytic anemia. That's an iron deficiency. This has a macrocytic anemia. So here you have a 45-year-old female. She has a history of systemic scleroderma. She presents with about 6 months of diarrhea. She denies any other GI symptoms. She's undergone an EGD and colonoscopy. The biopsies are pretty unrevealing. You do stool tests, everything's normal. Small bowel follow-through reveals this jejunal diverticulum. What's the next best step in this patient? Do you want gastric emptying? Do you want a glucose breath test? Do you want an H. pylori breath test? Or do you want a push enteroscopy? So this patient likely has bacterial overgrowth. This is a direct consequence of the presence of the increased amounts of colonic-type bacterial flora in the small intestine. You'll see this scleroderma is kind of a clue to that. It can result in fat, carbohydrate, and protein malabsorption. You can have a macrocytic anemia. So you're going to see this in people who have a small bowel diverticulum, fistula from Crohn's disease, bypass of the intestine, so jejunal ileal for obesity, functional stasis, scleroderma, diabetes. So this is one that as gastroenterologists a lot of times will say, okay, do we have a high suspicion for this? We might just treat, but the gold standard is the breath test. So direct aspiration of of aerobes and anaerobes from the small bowel standard. Alternatives, you can do the breath testing, which is what we all do because it's much more readily available. If the cause is not correctable, then you need to trial antibiotics. So we next have a 34-year-old female. She presents with a 5-year history of quiescent Crohn's disease of the terminal ileum. The small bowel barium study shows nodularity, spiculation, and some mild luminal narrowing of just the last 10 centimeters of the terminal ileum. A deficiency of which of the following nutrients is most likely in this case? A, D, E, iron, or B12? So this one's actually iron. So let's go over why. So patients are susceptible to deficiencies in all nutrients that are listed, but the longer segment of TI or resection predisposes them to the bile acid depletion and fat soluble malabsorption. So that's the A, D, E, and K. So this patient, it said specifically, has just the last 10 centimeters there. In all of these patients, you can have iron deficiency from chronic blood loss with Crohn's disease. So then if you have a 44-year-old male with a history of short bowel syndrome, presents to the office with complaints of a scaly red rash on his face, groin, and hands, there's progressive alopecia, what do you think the most likely etiology of this is? Vitamin B12, copper deficiency, zinc deficiency, vitamin D, or vitamin E deficiency? Yep, I heard someone say it, zinc. This can occur with short gut syndrome, you get malabsorption. Those are the classic characteristics. They like zinc deficiency for some reason. Alopecia, loss of taste, poor wound healing, you get that scaly rash. So you have a 76-year-old female. She presents with glossitis, paresthesias, anorexia, and diarrhea. When you look at her labs, macrocytic anemia, she's got a hemoglobin of 10.6, MCV of 108. She's got normal folic acid. Which of the following is most likely the underlying cause of her symptoms of her anemia? Achlorhydria, zinc deficiency, small bowel angiotensias, or carcinoid? A. So you have patients that present with a vitamin B12 deficiency. They're going to have a megaloblastic anemia. B12 is found in animal products such as eggs, meat, and milk. Common symptoms, you're going to see glossitis, anorexia, diarrhea, paresthesias. This is due to the degeneration of the dorsal columns and the spinal cord, leading to decreased vibratory and proprioceptive sensation. So achlorhydria and pernicious anemia are a common cause of vitamin B12 deficiency in the elderly. This one, you have a 43-year-old woman. She presents to the office following bariatric surgery 3 months ago. She complains of a peripheral neuropathy. Her post-surgical course was complicated by frequent nausea, vomiting. She also had weakness, ataxia, muscle weakness, ataxia, and confusion. Which of the following do you think most likely is the explanation of her symptoms? Does she have a folic acid deficiency, vitamin B6, vitamin C deficiency, or vitamin B1 deficiency? So this is D. This is a thiamine deficiency following gastric bypass. It's pretty common. So they actually, especially in patients with significant post-op vomiting, it's sometimes referred to as bariatric beriberi. So they will screen for thiamine deficiency at baseline and then 6 months following the gastric bypass. So just a few other infectious things. Giardia, this is a big one that we see, intestinal infection caused by protozoal parasite, Giardia. It's predominantly noted in the preschool age, especially daycare, homosexual males. But the thing that we talk about a lot, too, is contaminated freshwater sources worldwide, so mountain streams. Maybe you're going to see someone camping. About 70% of people, will have intestinal symptoms. They're going to get diarrhea, flatulence, cramps, bloating, nausea. Chronic diarrhea and malabsorption and weight loss can occur if it goes untreated. 20 to 25% of infected patients, though, are asymptomatic. So you want to get a stool study for this, immunoassays for the Giardia antigen. This is done in the lab. Rule out malabsorption with B12 albumin, stool fecal fat tests. You're going to treat them with, Flagyl is probably the main one that we end up using. So if you have a 45-year-old has had malabsorption for the last year with a low-volume diarrhea, polyarthralgias, occasional visual hallucinations, they have a physical exam that's pretty negative. The CAT scan shows some generalized lymphadenopathy. EGD shows broad flattened villi in the duodenum. Here's the key. Biopsies show numerous PAS-positive macrophages in the submucosa. What therapy is the most useful for this patient? Gluten-free diet, steroids, antibiotics, or antacids? This is C. This is Whipple's disease. Pretty rare, but is definitely seen. It's an infectious condition that prevents small bowel from absorbing the nutrients. It can affect multiple organs. You might get the description that says foamy macrophages. Most commonly, these people are going to have arthralgias, weight loss, recurrent abdominal pain, diarrhea. CNS manifestations are also classic. This might be what gets them into the hospital.